Service Headquarters, or on the PPD or VPPD. In the tighter job markets of the early 1990s, this was a small price to pay for the stability of a high-paying and well-respected job as a Secret Service agent. But as the late 1990s technology economy took off, and as the post-September 11, 2001 federal law enforcement hiring boom followed, it made little sense to remain in a job where you were expected to uproot your family and move every few years when you could earn the same amount of money or more in another federal law enforcement position or the private sector. There were few policies in the Secret Service despised more than the informal, "you have to take a move" policy. Adding insult to injury, many of the headquarters-based managers who had the power to fix these problems instead dismissed the concerns of a growing body of agents who were rapidly tiring of endless travel in support of the protection mission and the pressure to constantly relocate to places where they had no roots. Yet, despite the changing job conditions in the economy at large, and the dramatic post-9/11 uptick in hiring among other federal law enforcement agencies that had no such relocation requirement, the Secret Service management refused to change the informal relocation policy while making only token changes to the career track options for agents. In an effort to stem the growing tide of discontent surrounding the extensive protection-related travel and the unnecessary relocation requirement, Secret Service management introduced new career tracks intended to allow special agents to stay in one field office and avoid relocating their families. But although agents were now eligible for a new investigative career track, created in response to the attrition problem resulting from the relocation requirement, enabling them to stay in their original field office for an extended period of time, management never took the career track seriously. Agents who chose the new investigative career track quickly figured out that it was a raw deal in two respects. First, many of the agents who chose the new career track in order to spend more time with their families and avoid relocating to new homes in faraway places often found their families alone anyway, as the agents were still being bombarded with rota protection assignments on the road. Second, most of the agents who chose not to relocate in favor of the new investigative career track were locked out of promotion assignments because they never served on a protection detail and were subsequently ineligible to bid for promotion on supervisory positions on those protective details. Combine this with the inescapable reality within the Secret Service that the culture was one that valued service on a full-time protection detail. Agents who never served in these protective assignments were viewed as second-class citizens, and the pressure to relocate and join a protective detail, or to find another job in federal law enforcement, became overwhelming. The Secret Service could have solved this problem, and the NSSE problem, and the ECTF problem, and the never-ending mission creep problem, by simply stating the obvious. The Secret Service had outgrown their investigative mission. By focusing exclusively on the protection mission and abandoning portions of the investigative mission no longer suited to their workforce capacities, the Secret Service would only have to relocate a special agent once, when the agent was hired. The relocation requirement for special agents was a hammer to agent morale that the Secret Service still has not recovered from. And the failure to change this organizational relic or to streamline the Secret Service's mission is the fault of Secret Service management, who seemingly cannot see the forest for the trees. But another morale killer in the Secret Service, which is not the fault of Secret Service management, is the salary cap imposed upon its special agents. The Secret Service is one of the few federal law enforcement agencies that pays overtime. Most federal law enforcement agents have overtime pay built into their regular paychecks through a program called LEAP, Law Enforcement Availability Pay, where the agent's salary requirements are covered by an annual salary plus an additional 25% of his or her salary to cover anticipated overtime hours. LEAP largely covers the additional overtime hours federal law enforcement agents routinely work, in addition to their 8-hour workdays, to compensate the agents for such things as after-hour surveillance operations, arrests, and other investigative operational requirements that wouldn't ordinarily fit into a standard 8-hour workday. As a result, most federal agencies don't routinely pay additional overtime outside of LEAP, because it's rare for their agents to work more than the 25% LEAP supplement included in their pay package. This is not the case with Secret Service agents. The investigative and protection-related mission creep and the relocation requirements caused an attrition death spiral beginning in the early 2000s that continues through today. As the special agent workforce shrunk, not in nominal terms, but relative to the expanding Secret Service mission, and the hiring of new agents struggled to keep pace, the remaining agents were forced to pick up additional rota assignments, which resulted in millions of dollars in additional overtime costs accrued as a result of having to pay a smaller cadre of agents for more hours worked. The mission requirements of the Secret Service are clear. When a security plan calls for 30 agents to stand post at a rally site for a Secret Service protectee, then the Secret Service is going to find exactly 30 agents to fulfill the mission. They don't really care how long you've been on the road or how tired you are if you're one of the agents assigned the task. Working without days off and traveling from state to state with little sleep in support of the protection mission is tedious enough, but doing it for no additional compensation has been devastating to the agent workforce. Secret Service agent compensation, along with other federal agent pay, is legislatively capped at approximately $160,000 per year, and in busy election seasons, which now run up to 2 years long, it is not uncommon for agents to max out their overtime pay by April or May. Note, the federal fiscal year used for budgeting and to calculate compensation runs from October to the end of September, not January to the end of December. Once an agent is maxed out, Secret Service jargon for earning the maximum amount of money allowable under the salary cap, then that agent cannot earn any more overtime pay, and any hours worked and accumulated after his or her 40-hour work week, plus the agent's 10 hours of LEAP per week, are uncompensated. I fully understand how many of you reading this would question why this is such a big deal. After all, $160,000 per year is a lot of money. Yes, you are correct. That is a lot of money for a position within the federal government, and no Secret Service agent I know would dispute that. But it's not the amount of money that most of the agents have a problem with. It's the structure of their pay relative to other federal law enforcement agencies that has damaged Secret Service morale. Here's a simple test. Would you remain in a job that asks you to work 70-plus hours a week for the same salary as a similar job requiring only 50 hours a week? My guess is you probably wouldn't. Many agents stay behind because they love the mission of the Secret Service and they love their country. But many are leaving to take positions with the BATF, the IRS, the DEA, the FBI, and other agencies because they and their families are simply burned out from spending close to a decade of their lives on the road. I remember having a conversation with a former Secret Service agent who had resigned to take a position with another federal law enforcement agency. He told me that his boss's desk was littered with applications and resumes from Secret Service agents looking to leave the Secret Service and join his agency. It was depressing to hear. No one wants to be part of an agency where they feel as though they are going to be the last one to turn the lights out as everyone leaves. The Secret Service cannot effectively protect the president in the future with its current portfolio of problems. Mission creep has saddled the Secret Service with an expanded plate of responsibilities that it no longer has the manpower, budget, or training to effectively handle. Poor management decisions, made with the best interests of upper-level Secret Service management, but the worst interests of the working agents in the field in mind, have also ravaged the workforce and destroyed both special agent morale and faith in the leadership. When combined with a special agent pay scale that incentivizes Secret Service agents to seek employment elsewhere within the federal law enforcement alphabet soup of agencies, it's no surprise that failures have begun to pile up within the Secret Service. No organization, whether public or private, can be expected to perform at an elite level and with zero operational errors while simultaneously losing their best employees and saddling those who remain with hostility toward the organization and its leadership. Chapter 2. The Uniformed Division Officer Mess. All too often when I read media reports about newsworthy events involving the Secret Service, the reporter incorrectly identifies the Secret Service personnel involved. The Secret Service, as currently constituted, has two separate entities with different, albeit slightly overlapping, functions. The Secret Service Special Agents side of the agency is responsible for the protection of the President of the United States. The special agents follow the President around both on and off the White House grounds. They are the body men. They surround and protect the human body elected to the office of the U.S. Presidency. You've likely seen the special agent side of the Secret Service as portrayed in popular culture and movies, such as In the Line of Fire, starring Clint Eastwood, and on the criminal investigative side, as portrayed in movies such as To Live and Die in L.A., starring William Peterson. Secret Service special agents do not wear uniforms, and they are most often dressed in suits and ties, with their weapons, ammunition, communications gear, handcuffs, and flashlights concealed underneath their suit jackets. They are recognizable by their lapel pins, which change often for security measures, and their iconic earpieces. The earpiece has become so tied to the image of the Secret Service special agent that I often heard White House staffers speak of earpiece envy, their desire for an earpiece-wearing security detail of their own because of the impressive visual that creates. Having served on the special agent side of the Secret Service, and having protected many of these high-ranking executive branch personnel, I always found this to be a curious phenomenon. After a few months of having a full-time Secret Service protective detail, most of the people I protected, outside of the President, found it slightly embarrassing being followed around constantly by burly special agents in suits and earpieces. I recall an incident with one protectee who was trying to get a haircut on a weekend in suburban Maryland. Horrified at the thought of a couple of guys in suits standing over the barber during the haircut, the protectee preferred that we wait outside of the barbershop. Ironically, the earpiece as a distinguishing mark of who is and who isn't a Secret Service agent brings with it some comedy. While working a presidential daughter's detail in Northern California with an agent friend of mine, the earpiece, or lack thereof, actually saved us from being outed as agents. I was holding the cars that day. An agent always stays with the vehicles to ensure the quick availability of an escape option and to prevent an adversary from planting a listening device or explosive on the car. And my partner for the day walked back to the car with the protectee and started laughing. I asked him what was so funny, and he said he had been in a high-end shoe store with the protectee when two women thought they recognized her and began to loudly wonder whether that was her or a doppelganger. The women went back and forth for a moment saying, "Is it her?" before settling on the fact that it couldn't be her because there were no Secret Service agents around. How did they come to that conclusion? One woman told the other, "We would see their Secret Service earpieces." The earpiece marker has also led to some uncomfortable moments with low-level White House staff members during my career. In my early days on the Presidential Protective Division, I was assigned to an overseas trip with President George W. Bush, and one of the White House staffers we were working with got himself caught up in a small imbroglio surrounding an earpiece. A lesson I learned early on in my tenure as a Secret Service agent is that in many formerly communist and authoritarian countries, the people that make the decisions for the foreign government hold the gun carriers in high esteem. As one military security representative, sometimes it's difficult to appropriately distinguish between these two roles in countries with a history of authoritarian rule, once told me, He who has the guns has the power. The low-level White House staffer on the trip learned this lesson early in the visit, and every time he was asked by a host government representative, not familiar with the staff Secret Service breakdown, if he was a Secret Service agent, he would say, "I'm with the Secret Service." Now, technically, he wasn't lying. He was with the Secret Service, but he wasn't actually with the Secret Service. But he had a radio and an earpiece, and he needed to get things done. And he knew that the host government would likely ignore him if they knew he was a low-level staff member with no gun. So he kept up the charade of being with the Secret Service for days. The charade came to a halt when a host government representative approached me and told me he was going to move a piece of equipment because the Secret Service agent told me to. I asked him which agent had told him that, and he pointed to the White House staff member. I'd had enough at this point. This staff member and I had some history. And although it was going to be uncomfortable because I really didn't want to embarrass the poor guy, I called him over and asked him point blank, "Did you tell this guy you were a Secret Service agent?" He started to sweat, and I knew he was cornered. I asked the host government official to leave to avoid further embarrassing the staffer, but I wasn't going to let it go without letting him know the gravity of what he did. "Impersonating a federal agent is a crime," I told him. Granted, calling this particular incident a crime was probably a stretch, but this staffer was causing some problems on the trip and needed a stern warning. And I warned him that if he did it again, it was going up the chain. Secret Service lingo for getting White House and Secret Service management involved. The staffer kept the earpiece in his ear after that, but, thankfully, dropped the "I'm with the Secret Service" act. The other side of the Secret Service, not immediately recognizable by the suits and earpiece combination, although they have earpieces too, is the uniformed division. Uniformed division personnel are not agents. They are federal police officers, and they are recognizable by their black and white police-style uniforms. Most uniformed division officers wear a standard white button-down collared shirt with the presidential seal on the left shoulder and a black tie in the winter and fall months. Due to the oppressive Washington, D.C. heat, they wear white short-sleeve shirts with no tie in the spring and summer months. Their pants are black and otherwise indistinct. The Secret Service uniformed division uniform was routinely mocked, oftentimes by the officers themselves. A few of my agent friends who had transferred to the special agent side from the uniformed division told me they hated the uniform, and that they used to derisively call it the Black Knights of the Potomac uniform. The uniformed division is separate and distinct from the agent side of the Secret Service, and although they fall under the collective Secret Service agency umbrella, they have separate functions, job categories, and job descriptions. Secret Service agents are GS 1811 designated federal employees with the official titles Criminal Investigator and Special Agent, while uniformed division officers are federal police officers. Today's Secret Service Uniform Division came about when the Secret Service absorbed the White House police force and their responsibilities. In contrast to the special agent's primary responsibility, which is to protect the physical body elected to the U.S. presidency, the uniformed division's primary role in the presidential security plan is to protect the White House structure, whether the president is physically present or not. Notice the difference here, because this is where the media frequently screws up the reporting of security incidents at the White House. The agents secure the physical body, not the White House structure. Therefore, if a fence jumper at the White House jumps the fence when the president is not at the White House, then there is a slim chance that special agents will intervene to stop it, because they would be with the president on the road, not at the White House. But you'll frequently hear media figures report that the fence jumpers were apprehended by agents, when in the overwhelming majority of incidents, they were not apprehended by agents, but by uniformed division officers. It may seem like nitpicking, but this persistent mistake drives many agents crazy because As we saw with both Omar J. Gonzalez, the North Grounds fence jumper who made it all the way into the White House in late 2014, and Jonathan Tran, the North Side Treasury Building fence jumper who made it all the way to the South Portico of the White House, it was primarily uniformed division personnel, not special agents, who were responsible for the security lapses. I am not pointing this out to pile on the uniformed division. After all, the special agent side has had their own share of debacles, ranging from the Columbia scandal to the two agents caught taking selfies with President Trump's grandson. I am pointing it out because diagnosing and fixing the security lapses at the White House requires that we identify the correct set of personnel, or else there's little chance of fixing the problem. Also, it hurts morale on both the agent and the uniform division sides of the Secret Service when one side, having little responsibility for a security problem, is held to account for something they didn't do. I, along with a number of other still active agent friends of mine, have vivid memories of the Omar Gonzalez fence-jumping incident and the widespread Secret Service mockery that followed. Although I had long since resigned from the Secret Service, I remember being at my daughter's bus stop, waiting for the bus to pick her up, when a few of my neighbors were laughing at the incompetence of the Secret Service agents because they couldn't stop a war veteran with a bad knee from leaping the North Lawn fence and making it into the White House. They were surprised when I informed them that the agents had left just minutes earlier with President Obama from the opposite side of the White House as he departed for Camp David on Marine One, and that it was uniformed division personnel involved in the breach. Ironically, it was an off-duty special agent from the counter-assault team who tackled Gonzalez on the state floor of the White House and stopped a disturbing incident from becoming a disastrous one. The Gonzalez fence-jumping incident was a catastrophic security failure on the uniformed division side. Yet the failure was inevitable given the treatment of, and the poor management of, the rank-and-file officers of the uniformed division. I spent nearly 5 years as a Secret Service agent assigned to the White House as a member of the PPD, and I cannot recall a time where the uniformed division officers were treated with the dignity and respect afforded to police officers in the streets, where I worked as an NYPD police officer. Thankfully, most people will have limited interaction with police officers throughout their lives. It's this limited interaction that maintains the air of mystery surrounding police work and, I believe, provides for the high degree of respect most people have for police officers. It's rare to find an adult who doesn't remember playing cops and robbers while growing up, and few people would dispute the fact that it takes a tremendous amount of bravery to be a police officer. So, why is uniformed division police officer morale consistently poor as measured by job satisfaction surveys and anecdotal reports? I attribute some of the mistreatment of the uniformed division officers and the corresponding morale problems to the familiarity many of the employees at the White House have with the uniformed division officers. Unlike the average American citizen, who rarely interacts with police officers, the White House personnel see the same uniformed division officers every day when reporting to work at the White House complex. And as a result of the familiarity, many of the officers have subsequently been treated as second-rate security guards when working because the allure and mystery of the police officer brand wore off. Nearly every uniformed division officer I spoke with at the White House when I was assigned to the Presidential Protective Division had a troubling story about a member of the White House staff who had mistreated them. This mistreatment would often happen at the magnetometer checkpoints at the White House staff entrances. The dreaded, "Do you know who I am?" line was a common component of these horror stories. Ironically, the uniformed division officers who would tell me these stories said that it was rarely, if ever, senior White House staff members who would engage in this type of obnoxious behavior with the officers. One officer told me that the degree of the obnoxious and pretentious behavior was inversely correlated with the degree of access the White House staff member had to the president. During the George W. Bush years, Complaints about the pretentious behavior of senior advisers such as Karl Rove or Fran Townsend, both had reputations for treating both uniformed division officers and special agents with respect and dignity, were unheard of. But it was quite common to hear complaints about low-level staffers and new White House employees treating the uniformed division officers like a bunch of servants. Compounding this problem was the oft-reported complaint that the sergeants and the lieutenants of the uniformed division wouldn't back up their officers when a staff-officer conflict happened. Officers would relay to me that they were told to just let it go, even when they were unquestionably on the right side of the dispute with a White House staff member. This may seem like a minor complaint, but low morale due to mistreatment by uniformed division management and some members of the White House staff was extremely destructive to the security posture of the White House because of the officer attrition that resulted. The persistently low uniformed division officer morale, combined with the mediocre pay compared to other federal law enforcement positions, created a witch's brew of conditions for a death spiral of attrition to set in among the uniformed division officer class. The officers of the uniformed division, due to their necessary proximity to the president, are granted a difficult-to-obtain top-secret security clearance as a condition of their continued employment as officers. Once this security clearance is granted to the officer, it becomes a tradable commodity in the constantly churning Washington, D.C. law enforcement intelligence community job soup. It wasn't uncommon for me to be working a midnight shift at the White House and chatting with a rookie uniformed division officer, only to find out the next night that he had left to take a position somewhere else, either within the federal law enforcement or intelligence community, or within the government consulting field, where a top-secret security clearance is a game-changer on a resume. This caused severe problems within the ranks of the uniformed division, because as more officers resigned, the ones who stayed behind were forced into double shifts and unmanageable work schedules, which further destroyed morale for the officers left behind. Sadly, the same phenomenon that occurred on the agent side of the Secret Service. As this attrition death spiral continued over the course of years, the uniformed division was left with an experience vacuum for mid-career officers. The veteran officers, close to retirement, typically remained with the Secret Service, despite the poor working conditions. They had already invested nearly two decades of their lives with the uniformed division, and they weren't going to forfeit that experience to start over somewhere else. But the newer officers turned over at unmanageable rates as they became more experienced, obtained their security clearances, and built up their resumes. This left the uniformed division stacked with inexperienced rookies, afraid to make waves at the White House because the management was likely going to abandon them, and officers close to retirement who were in FIGMO mode, as it was called, F it, I got my orders. In other words, I'm out of here soon, so leave me alone. Given the poor management, the even worse treatment by the White House staff, and the attrition problems with the officers of the Secret Service Uniform Division, it's no surprise to observers of the Secret Service, active and retired alike, that both Omar J. Gonzalez and Jonathan Tran were able to circumvent the White House security plan, the censors, the emergency response team, also members of the Uniform Division, and the officers on duty during both of these infamous incidents. There are some solutions to the uniformed division problems that the Secret Service should strongly consider. First, although I strongly support limited government spending, the Secret Service will continue to struggle to retain officers in the uniformed division if they do not pay them commensurate with the inflated cost of living in the Washington, D.C. metro area, where most of their officers are stationed. This is simply a function of basic arithmetic. Suppose uniformed division officer Smith makes X amount of money as a uniformed division officer at the White House, but has to put up with rude staffers, terrible hours, and a uniformed division management that throws him under the bus. Then, Officer Smith is offered a job at a Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm, requiring the top-secret security clearance that he already has, and for more money than the officer is making with the uniform division. Of course Officer Smith is going to leave. The uniform division pay scale must be fixed to reflect the competitive D.C. job market for security-cleared personnel, or the attrition death spiral among their officers will continue. Second, the special agent side of the Secret Service should be assigned internship-type training days, where they are assigned to learn about, monitor, and eventually oversee the uniform division's White House operations. The special agents assigned to the White House work alongside the uniformed division officers whenever the president is physically present on the White House grounds. Yet, each side knows little about what the other side does. This knowledge gap creates a corresponding lack of understanding between special agents and officers, along with a noticeable friction between the officers and the agents. This damages morale on both sides. I knew many of the uniformed division officers by last name only, and unfortunately, when I was assigned to the White House, I couldn't tell you much about their shift rotations, their work hours, or their specific roles during a crash, Secret Service jargon for a White House intrusion. The special agents spend so much time drilling and rehearsing their specific roles in an intrusion and potential evacuation of the president during a crash, while focusing intently on physically moving the president, that they are largely blind to the security of the White House structure, many figuring, uniformed divisions got that. But if the agents assigned to the White House were nearly as familiar with the White House structural security plan as they were with the evacuation plan, then I'm sure the Jonathan Tran intrusion in March 2017 wouldn't have happened as it did. Tran jumped the north fence of the Treasury building and then jumped two subsequent fences on the southeast side of the White House to access the south grounds. Unbelievably, Tran nearly made it into the White House while President Trump was physically present. The location of the incident is critical because the external east side of the White House, where Tran made his way to the south grounds, is an area where the president rarely goes. He stays mostly contained to the East Wing residence and the West Wing. And for that reason, most special agents aren't as familiar with that White House territory. The alarms in this area and the zones are all numbered, and I'm reasonably confident that many of the agents working that night, both in the Secret Service Operations Center and with President Trump at the White House, were unsure of the exact location of the crash and the intruder. Focusing more on officer and special agent cooperation through internships would do wonders to solve the information gaps among the agents and officers. It would also help build camaraderie between a uniformed division that sees itself as the red-headed stepchildren of the White House and the special agents of the Secret Service, who would benefit greatly from an expanded base of knowledge about the structural security plan at the White House. Third, the uniformed division must engage in a vigorous hiring effort to both replenish and stabilize its workforce. An increase in officer manpower would allow them to dramatically increase their personnel presence at the White House. A critical problem I often noticed at the White House was static posting with limited pushes. A push in the Secret Service is a break, and asking uniformed division officers assigned to late-night and overnight shifts to stand in the same spot for hours at a time while maintaining maximum alertness and response capabilities is absurd and defies human physiology. Movement and fresh eyes are key components of any security plan, and expecting an officer to stand and stare at a door in the White House with just a few breaks over an 8-hour shift is problematic. Fatigue, distraction, boredom, and even counting exercises. I'm not kidding. An officer once told me that he would keep his mind occupied by counting the components of the ornate crown molding on the White House state floor are just a few factors that can render an officer assigned to the White House less than effective during a crash. If the uniformed division doubled the officer personnel at the White House, then the officers would be constantly moving around to push each other, and with each moving officer, a fresh set of eyes, not one that has been staring at walls for hours at a time, would be set upon the White House terrain. Fresh eyes notice things that tired eyes often miss, and this can be the difference between a security success and a mission-critical failure. A heavy rotation of officer manpower also provides for backup personnel during a White House crash, and it would cure some of the crushing morale resulting from long shifts staring at the White House walls, which haven't changed in decades. Fourth, an increase in officer personnel would also allow the uniformed division officers to train to appropriately defend the White House. Can you fathom asking a football team to execute a successful series of plays that they have rarely practiced? In sports, the movements and the coordination between the players on the field must be rehearsed repeatedly to overcome the tendency to overthink a response rather than react. A credible White House crash with an active intruder is a serious and stressful event. Stress causes inescapable biological responses, including dilated pupils, accelerated breathing, and the loss of fine motor skills. The only way to overcome the debilitating effects of human biology and defeat these stress-caused physiological responses is to repeatedly train under simulated stress conditions. The repeated drilling of a defined motor response can assist a law enforcement officer in overriding the natural biological response to stress and to more efficiently respond to a threat. In 2014, an independent panel known as the United States Secret Service Protective Mission Panel, formed in response to multiple Secret Service organizational failures. Shockingly, a December 2014 report submitted to Congress by the panel exposed the shameful fact that for fiscal year 2013, the uniform division as a whole received 576 hours of training, or about 25 minutes for each of over 1,300 uniformed division officers. 25 minutes of training per officer? Think about that. If you work on an advanced assembly line or at a consulting firm, there's a darn good chance that you received more job training in a month than the officers assigned to protect the most targeted facility on earth, the White House, received in a year. There's an enormous chasm between talking about a response to a White House crash and actually walking through the physical motions of the crash response in a training exercise. I have little doubt that the clear lack of training and the lack of urgency to reinstitute a rigorous training program contributed to the uniform division mess and has left the President of the United States vulnerable to attack in the White House. Chapter 3. The Evolving Threats from the Big Six. It was March 2007, and I was staring out of a slightly smog-stained window on the upper floor of a Bogota hotel at the picturesque Colombian mountains. There was a hint of fog on the mountains, which blended in seamlessly with the green trees, and the vista served as a welcome distraction from the non-stop stress of the upcoming presidential visit by President George W. Bush. I had been a special agent with the Secret Service for 8 years at the time, but I was still relatively new to the Presidential Protective Division, and this was my first major protection assignment with the PPD. A senior agent who served as a mentor to me once described being a Secret Service agent as the longest job interview in the world. He was right. Although Secret Service agents go through a nearly year-long training program at both the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Brunswick, Georgia, and the Secret Service Training Academy in Prince George's County, Maryland, known as the JJRTC, or the James J. Rowley Training Center, nothing can prepare you for the stress and persistent anxiety that accompanies you while attempting to design a security plan to thwart the numerous potential attacks against the president. The senior agent referred to the evolution of a Secret Service agent's career as the longest job interview in the world because every noteworthy assignment an agent was given served to check a box, another expression used frequently among agents, on a long checklist of security assignments that was largely informal but understood by special agents as a barometer for a successful Secret Service career. I was approximately halfway through the career checklist when I was assigned to secure the Colombian Presidential Palace, the Casa de Nariño, for President Bush's 2007 visit to Bogotá, Colombia. The presidential palace had been attacked using mortars and projectiles just 5 years earlier, injuring 3 soldiers, and the looming threat of another attack while President Bush was present was causing me a lot of lost sleep during the protective advance phase of the Secret Service security operation. Compounding the anxiety was my poor health at the time. I had returned to the United States from Panama prematurely just weeks earlier due to illness, and I still wasn't feeling well. I had contracted dengue fever while on a protection operation in Panama City, Panama, with first daughter Jenna Bush, and when my fever spiked to over 103 degrees, the Secret Service supervisor overseeing the operation made the decision to send me home to recover. Knowing that there was a fixed and limited period of time while assigned to the Presidential Protective Division to check the boxes, I didn't take much time off to recover. When I arrived home, I asked the operations section of the PPD to plug me in if they had an open assignment for a major site security assignment. A major site security advance was a necessary box to check to be taken seriously as an agent on the PPD. The checklist progression works like this. New agents to the PPD are first assigned to secure airports, because most U.S. and international airports have been advanced many times before. Also, most major airports expecting a visit from Air Force One already have detailed security plans in place, which the Secret Service supplements with their own personnel and equipment. After successfully securing an airport, PPD agents are assigned a small, non-airport site to secure. An example of a small site would be a grip-and-grin type of event, where the president goes to a home or office building and shakes hands with a limited number of people, typically followed by a short speech. These small sites are challenging for new agents to the PPD, but the small crowds, limited floor space to secure, and easy-to-manage flow of people and press make them ideal opportunities for newer PPD agents to learn the critical skills necessary to secure the life of the president. Upon successful completion of a small site security plan, a PPD agent is then given a major site security advance box to check. If a sitting president has a limited travel schedule, as many 1980s-era special agents experienced with President Reagan, who had a limited foreign and domestic travel schedule after the assassination attempt at the Washington, D.C. Hilton, then these major sites can be difficult assignments to acquire because of their scarcity. And if an agent doesn't successfully complete a security plan for a major site, then the box checking stops, along with his or her career advancement on the PPD. Knowing the potential scarcity of major site security assignments got me back on my feet quickly, despite still recovering from a severe battle with dengue fever, a battle that cost me 20-plus pounds of body weight and sapped me of nearly all of my energy. Even getting dressed was a struggle while recovering. But when a friend of mine in the PPD operations section called me on my Secret Service assigned BlackBerry and said there was an opportunity approaching for a major site advance in Bogotá, if I was up to it, I jumped at the opportunity. After hanging up the phone, I immediately dragged my still-hurting body. The well-deserved nickname for dengue fever is break bone fever, out of bed, put on a suit, and drove into the White House complex to collect the materials and information for the major site in Bogotá. I was going to check this box even if it caused lasting damage to my body. One of the WHMO, White House Medical Office, doctors, had warned me in a phone call a few days earlier, while checking up on me, not to return to South America until I was completely recovered, because the human immune system can work against you once you contract dengue fever. If you acquire a different type of the infection a second time, you can contract hemorrhagic fever, where your organs bleed internally and death is a possibility. Although the idea of liquefied organs scared the hell out of me, I knew if I didn't take the assignment, then someone else would jump on it. I was all in. And that's how I wound up on the upper floor of the hotel room in Bogota, staring at the beautiful mountain views. I was staring out the window and not working on my security plan for the presidential palace because I was patiently waiting to speak with the lead advance agent on the trip, Nick. Lead advance agents on foreign security advances were the most respected advance agents in the Secret Service. Only the best of the best agents were permitted to act as lead advance agents, overseeing the security of the life of the most powerful man on Earth, while in a potentially dangerous foreign country. After competing with hundreds of agents for the extremely limited spots on the PPD, only a handful of spots open up each year, and most Secret Service agents will never be selected to protect the president full-time as a member of the PPD, then you have to compete throughout your career on the hyper-competitive PPD with fellow agents to check the boxes and advance your career. After conducting a successful major site advance, then an agent would be in line for a logistics assignment. Logistics advances are a nightmare. Logistics agents are responsible for getting every agent, vehicle, weapon, and piece of security equipment into a foreign country and making sure everything arrives both on time and in working order. There is no room for error for a logistics advance agent. You cannot forget a presidential limo at home in the United States or leave it behind at a foreign airport because a customs official in a foreign country is being difficult. You can't forget to assign a flight or a hotel room to a PPD shift agent assigned to guard the president's six, a military and law enforcement term for providing rear coverage, and then tell that agent to stay home. It doesn't work that way. This is why a logistics advance assignment is the final box to be checked before being assigned to lead advance school, where PPD agents learn the skills necessary to act as a lead advance agent. Logistic assignments separate the wheat from the chaff, and if a PPD agent can keep it together and manage international logistics successfully, then that agent can move up into the rarefied air of lead advance agents. That's where Nick found himself on the Secret Service PPD career ladder during the Bogota, Colombia trip. Nick wasn't only the lead advance qualified agent on the PPD Bogota advance, but he was one of few agents on the PPD who had checked enough boxes to qualify as a foreign lead advance agent. Acting as a lead advance agent within the United States was a difficult assignment because domestic lead advance agents are responsible for everything that happens on the presidential visit. Although the airport agent, the small site agents, the major site agent, me during this Colombia trip, the transportation agent, and the logistics agent all work for the lead advance agent on a presidential visit, the top supervisor on the PPD, the SAIC, special agent in charge, will deal almost exclusively with the lead advance agent on a presidential visit. That means that even if I were to blow it at the Colombian presidential palace by designing a terrible security plan, Nick would also be the one to feel the wrath of the SAIC. I respected Nick, as did most of the agents on the PPD, and I was waiting to speak to him in that hotel room because I needed some guidance on handling the overwhelming number of name checks the Colombian intelligence services had given me. While talking about how to conduct the name checks, we veered off into a larger discussion about how to handle and prioritize threats to the president. That's where the Big Six conversation started. Nick told me to spend the majority of my time developing plans to neutralize threats from tactical assaults, medical emergencies, chemical, biological agents, explosives, airborne assaults, and fires. Although it was a simple way to sum up the threat picture, it served as a guide for me for the remainder of my career. Threats from the Big Six will haunt you throughout your career as a Secret Service agent, as you develop new and creative ways to learn to react to threats as quickly as the terrorists and assassins can create them. Making matters worse is the evolving social media ecosystem and 24-hour news cycle. The omnipresence of cell phone cameras and social media platforms has made every American with a social media presence and a cell phone a potential celebrity reporter. This has made this generation of political candidates and politicians extra sensitive about their public personae, which just decades ago were only public if you saw them on the news, on the streets outside the Capitol, or at a county fair. Now, every breath, utterance, and action has the potential to end a politician's career, because a camera or recording device is rarely more than arm's length away. No soundbite will be left spared if some entrepreneurial citizen or reporter can get it recorded. This possibility of being recorded at all times has made the extremely stressful job of being a Secret Service agent almost impossible. For example, put yourself in the shoes of the Secret Service supervisor on duty with Hillary Clinton on September 11, 2016. As the world watched the solemn remembrance of the September 11, 2001 attacks at Ground Zero, many noticed Hillary Clinton exit the event suspiciously early. Despite some initial spin, Fox News Channel's Rick Leventhal accurately reported that Mrs. Clinton left the event early due to a medical episode, and a now infamous video taken by a private citizen would later show Mrs. Clinton struggling to stand on her feet and nearly collapsing as a Secret Service van pulled up to the curb and escorted her from the scene. I was an instructor in the Secret Service Academy, and I was a program manager for the rewriting of the Secret Service investigative training course for new agents. I know what agents are taught in the Secret Service Training Academy because I helped write and teach the curriculum. I took part in hundreds of mock emergency medicine and AOP exercises, assault on principle drills, where we rehearsed the response to a mock attack. And I cannot recall a single episode where an actor playing the president, or another Secret Service protectee, in a training exercise, pretended to lose consciousness, and the response was anything other than to immediately seek out a hospital or advanced medical care. But that's not what happened on September 11th, 2016, with Hillary Clinton and her protective detail. She was taken to her daughter, Chelsea's apartment in Manhattan, instead. And although I obviously was not in the apartment with Mrs. Clinton at the time, I can definitively state that the medical care she likely received there was not qualitatively similar to the care at New York City's finest emergency rooms. Now, to be clear, I am not trying to pin blame on the Secret Service agents on Mrs. Clinton's detail on that day. The purpose of this book is to highlight some of the pressures facing the Secret Service, the necessary fixes the Secret Service must make to avoid succumbing to these pressures, and what will inevitably happen if the Secret Service doesn't evolve and change the way it currently conducts the business of protection. The country cannot and should not accept a Secret Service where emergency medicine and critical security decisions during potentially life or death moments are unduly influenced by political decision makers. Chapter 4. The Threat of a Tactical Assault on the President. It wasn't a coincidence that Nick, the lead advance agent from the Columbia trip, named the tactical assault first when discussing threats from the Big Six. The grave threat to the life of the President of the United States from a trained team of well-armed, body-armor-clad terrorists is difficult to manage, even for the elite agents of the PPD. The threat is so serious that the Secret Service protection model relies heavily on law enforcement and military assets outside of the agency to help counter the threat from a tactical assault. While coordinating security for a portion of the inauguration route on Pennsylvania Avenue for Barack Obama's first presidential inauguration in 2008, a prominent member of the broadcast media asked me, "How do you guys do all this?" I responded, "We don't." I wasn't suggesting that the Secret Service wasn't responsible for the security of the president. I was trying to emphasize to the media figure that though we, the Secret Service, designed the security plan, it's a largely symbiotic effort between the Secret Service, the military, local police, and state and federal law enforcement that enables the Secret Service to manage enormous security undertakings, such as a presidential inauguration. If the Secret Service were forced to protect the president with no help from outside agencies and law enforcement personnel, the president would undoubtedly be put in immediate and grave danger. The Secret Service doesn't have the manpower or local expertise to secure every street corner the president visits during his time in office. Moreover, the Secret Service cannot, during a week-long security advance, the average length of a difficult security advance, match the lifetime of accumulated local intelligence in the minds of the dedicated local law enforcement, many of whom have spent years patrolling America's streets. The Secret Service, with few exceptions, has always maintained a strong working relationship with local and state law enforcement because they have to. Unlike the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies, where the relationship can be tense at times with local law enforcement, as jurisdictional fights and the ever-present fights for access to classified information muddy up the jurisdictional waters, the Secret Service cannot perform its basic and most important job, keeping the president safe without outside help. Imagine security around the president as a series of concentric rings, with access to each ring determined by the level of training and the specific job function of the agent or officer. The outer and middle security rings are almost exclusively the domain of local and state law enforcement personnel, under the watch of a smaller number of Secret Service agents. There is a sensible reason for this concentric ring structure and the use of local law enforcement personnel to man the middle and outer rings. No one knows the neighborhood terrain features, the local players, and what should and shouldn't be in a neighborhood like the local police officers. Years of patrol experience have trained the eyes of our nation's local police officers to spot anything out of the ordinary, and any terrorist assault team using explosives and automatic rifles to initiate a tactical assault will most likely begin their assault on the outer ring first. They begin here, far from the president, because the ring of magnetometers surrounding locations the president visits have been pushed out farther and farther as the threat from suicide vests and other explosives has grown. It does the Secret Service no good to place their magnetometers just feet away from a location the president may walk by, because a bomber could approach the magnetometer checkpoint and detonate before walking through. The trained eyes and ears of the nation's local law enforcement officers are the front lines of protection against the nightmare tactical assault that would stress even the most well-designed Secret Service security plan. Having them on the outside perimeter is a significant force multiplier that can stop an attack in a parking lot rather than on the inside of a secure venue. The stress and chaos of having to deal with multiple attackers, loud explosions, blinding and deafening percussion blasts, and rifle rounds whizzing past Secret Service agents and law enforcement personnel at thousands of feet per second is tough to replicate in a training environment. I remember being a young agent in training at the Secret Service training facility in Maryland and going through a Hogan's Alley type exercise where agent trainees walk down the street and then all hell breaks loose. Instructors, in the role of the OPFOR, opposition force, pile out of buildings and start firing at the trainees, and the agent trainees are expected to respond using their tactical training. To add pain to the training scenario, pain is a terrific training tool for training young agents what not to do, the instructors used simmunition rounds in their training weapons. Simmunition rounds are plastic bullets with a soapy-textured colored substance in the plastic round to mark where the simmunition round lands when it hits a trainee. It happened to be a very cool late autumn day that training day, and we always hated simmunition training on cold days. The plastic rounds hardened up significantly in the cold weather, and if they hit you in the hands during the training exercise, then you would be in serious pain for the rest of the day, and you would have trouble moving your fingers. Aggravating the situation was that many tactical shooting exercises like this would naturally result in hits to the hands, because the one thing both sides, the OPFOR and the trainees, are always focused on during the back-and-forth shooting is the opponent's gun, and the gun is always in the hands. During this particular exercise, it was my turn, and I began my slow stroll down the street with its many false